I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Today we're talking about the cost and value of a college education. While more people are attending a college or university than a generation ago, many are saddled with debt and some of them did not even graduate. We'll talk about private for-profit trade schools, colleges, and universities with Aaron Schenck, head of the Pennsylvania Association of Private School Administrators. Sarah Goldrick-Robb, author of Paying the Price, tells us how to reduce student debt and why it's time for universal public higher education. But first, meet Aminata Si. She emigrated from Senegal, graduated from Community College of Philadelphia, and is now a junior at the University of Pennsylvania, majoring in international relations. And Aminata Si, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. I was reading about when you were at community college, you were determined to go to the University of Pennsylvania. What was the appeal for you? Why did you want to go to Penn?
Well, as you mentioned, my major is international relations. And my first professor at Community College of Philadelphia happened to have been also a professor at Penn. So with conversation, my own ambition to go to a place where I can really pursue my major in a way that will just advance me based on Penn's reputation and also based on the training that I get at Community College of Philadelphia and based on feedback from, again, my professors and other staff at the college, I thought Penn was possible for me. So that's why I really went for Penn.
How did community college prepare you for Ivy League college level work? And I think for a lot of people, that would be a big stretch. How did community college get you ready for that?
I would say community college got me very ready for Penn. And the way I knew that, not only in my mind did I know that as a student here, but the way I really knew it is when I became a student at Penn and took my first courses at Penn. So the first week at Penn, for example, I was given an assignment in which I was given seven different readings ranging average from 20 to 30 pages each. And my assignment was to actually summarize those readings and post them. So I wasn't used to this type of reading load at Community College of Philadelphia, but I was prepared to read and to just tackle the assignment. So after completing this assignment, I was like, it's over. That was this. It was the fifth day. It was exactly my fifth day at Penn, and I was able to do this, complete it, submit it, and did well on the assignment. So that just tells you how much Community College of Philadelphia prepared me for a place like Penn.
Well, congratulations on that. I know that sounds like a lot for any student. We know that not all students who attend college or university or community college graduate. From your perspective, what does a student need to do to do well?
I think personal determination is part of the process also, because sometimes when you're a student at community college, there are all these stereotypes about community colleges. Oh, maybe it's the 13th grade. Oh, maybe that has never been my experience at Community College of Philadelphia. They have excellent professors who get you ready and who are there to support you, answer your questions any way you want. And they have a lot of extra support also as far as tutors. If you are struggling, for example, English is my fourth language. So I didn't even come in with, I would say, a level of English that was college ready. But with the support system that's already in place at community college, if a student, again, self-determination is also part of the process. If a student is self-determinated to say, okay, this is where I am. I know that I'm not where I'm supposed to be yet, but I have all the support system around me, staff, faculty, as well as tutors who are here ready to help me, that I should seek out personally that help. I think that's a big part of the process also.
You're majoring in international relations, and you're a junior at the University of Pennsylvania. What do you hope to do with your degree?
I am looking at the Foreign Service. I want to be a U.S. Diplomat in the Foreign Service. So that's what I'm looking at, actually. And I've had the opportunity to actually meet many of them. Even 2 weeks ago, I went to the State Department and was able to ask really one-on-one questions to many of the diplomats that are doing the job that I aspire to do in the near future. So that's my goal at this point.
And you have a couple of kids. How do you juggle everything?
I will come back to the self-determination.
It comes back to self-determination. I hear you, yes. Aminata.
Yeah, it has been huge. And self-determination is part of it. Prioritizing is part of it. I feel like that really helped me, both as a student here at Community College of Philadelphia and also at Penn, being able to say, okay, what is more important in my day today? Not tomorrow, not 1 week from now, just today. When you wake up today, what is the most important thing that you need to worry about? 1, 2, 3, and just take it from there. I think that has been really helpful for me in my process, just juggling school, juggling marriage, having children. I think that has been huge, self-determination and being able to prioritize your time and how you're going to use it throughout your day.
What brought you to the United States? You were born in Senegal.
Yeah, I came here actually to join my husband, who's also here, and that's really why I came here. To join my husband, but in the process, obviously, I had other ambitions that I wanted to pursue, and that's what brought me to Community College of Philadelphia.
Are you going to have debt once you graduate? And this, of course, is such a big issue for so many students. Is this true for you as well?
Actually not. I cannot say that. I've been very fortunate. As a student at Community College of Philadelphia, I was able to actually receive a full scholarship when I was here attending. I would say a year, sort of like a year into my time at Community College of Philadelphia, I applied for their their scholarships. They have different ones, and I happened to be selected to one of their biggest scholarships. So that helped me pay for my education at Community College, and also I applied for a scholarship when I was going to Penn. I also got that scholarship, and that's going to help me pay for Penn. So in that sense, I was very fortunate.
Well, it's been a great pleasure talking to you, Aminata C. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome, and good luck to you as well. Again, emigrated from Senegal, graduated from Community College of Philadelphia, now a junior at the University of Pennsylvania, where she is majoring in international relations. Well, the increased cost of higher education has led to student debt, whether a graduate has gotten their diploma or not. The Obama administration recommended that students attend community college because they were more affordable than for-profit colleges. In fact, they instituted a gainful employment rule linking federal funds with the earnings and employment rates of graduates. The New York Times reported that 98% of failing programs were at for-profit colleges. We asked Sarah Goldrick-Robb to join us. She is professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University, author of a book called Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. She wrote in a New York Times room for debate that it was time for universal public higher education. A lot to talk about. Sarah Goldrick-Robb, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, call our comment line. Should that college degree, that first college degree, be cost-free? That phone number, 267-405-2006. You can also text us, 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Lots to talk about, but let's begin with this universal public higher education. Why are you a proponent of that?
Well, over time, over the last 50 years or so, this country has seen a major change. Not only have we sent more people all the way through high school to successful graduation, but we've also seen a really growing interest in attending college. And that's for very, very good reasons. One reason is that economically, it seems very important for people. They're able to get a decent job if they go to college. You know, I'm not talking about a bachelor's degree even. Mm-hmm. Just getting an associate degree can help them secure that. We've also seen wonderful other returns to going to college, things like longer lifespans, healthier lives, happier families, better and stronger communities. And while we've gone through that period, unfortunately, our system of financing higher education hasn't changed a bit. And so we've come to this moment where Americans from all walks of life want college, and the financing system is leaving it out of their reach, making it so hard for them to be able to complete their degrees without going deep into debt.
So
I think it's time for a change.
Should we think then of public higher education as we think of public education grades K through 12, for instance?
I think it is time for us to at least begin to have that discussion. you know, 100 years ago, and this is something that President Obama said frequently as well, 100 years ago we had a conversation about the need to move from only sending people to elementary school to beginning to send them to middle and high school because the world required more learning. Now we're at a time where you can't even fix a car with only your hands. It requires a computer. It is going to take more education to be successful in society, and the 13th and 14th years are basically required now.
You have said that student debt is a symptom. It's not the disease, but the symptom of a disease, the fact that college just costs too much. And it is interesting, there are grants and there are all sorts of ways to get student loans. But has all of that sort of fueled the higher costs of a college or university degree, assuming someone graduates?
Well, no, frankly, there isn't actually a lot of evidence for the common assumption that it's the financial aid that's making college cost more. What's making college cost more for most people today is that while more people started to demand an access to college and started to want to go to college, state legislators have tended to fund college less and less, passing the burden of paying for tuition on to students and their families. That's what's really driven the increase in price, and it's rendered taking a college loan non-optional. That's what people are really upset about. It's not the debt. It's the fact that you didn't have a choice about it.
Because a college, if you're talking about states pulling back from funding colleges and universities, we're talking largely about public colleges and universities, which, of course, are a little less, or in many ways, a lot less expensive than a private college or university.
In some cases, that's true. I mean, what's important to know is that 75% of Americans choose to go to college at a public college or university. And over time, some private colleges have actually become less expensive than publics, precisely because of what I described earlier, the declining state support. And that's a problem, and in many ways, it represents the sort of attack on public education that we've seen at the K-12 level, where we're saying, you know, public schools are failing, let's just send students to private schools. But it's not an accident that public schools are having trouble operating without the resources they need to succeed. So I think that it's time for us to have a much more vigorous discussion about the future of democracy in this country, which we know hinges in so many ways on access to public education at all levels.
Let me pick up on that, but first a very short break, talking with Sarah Goldrick-Robb, and again, professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University, author of a book called Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. We're going to take a very short break. I see comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and call or text our comment line, 267-405-20. And we will fold those comments, questions, responses into our conversation. Again, the comment line, 206-405-2006. You can text us, you can call us and leave a message. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Sarah Goldrick-Robb about the high cost of higher education and why she thinks there should be universal public higher education. And again, you can call our comment line 267-405-2006. Sarah, let me read an email from Megan. I'm sure you've heard this before. Does the guest think that making higher ed free will make some students value it less? I believe college should be affordable, but if it's completely free, will students lose the motivation to finish their degree in a timely manner? What do you say?
It makes me a little bit sad that over time the price of education has led us to think that people won't be motivated if only they don't pay a lot for it, when in fact there's very little evidence that that's actually true. So in my latest book, I walk you through an experiment that we conducted in Wisconsin where we paid students more money to help them pay for college, and we watched things like their effort in school. In fact, people who pay less money for college are able to devote more effort to school. They have more time, for example, to get ready for class. They have more time to sleep to eat, to do the things that you need to do to be ready to learn. And so, in fact, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of truth to the idea that people have to pay in order to want to try hard to succeed. The returns to college, frankly, the fact that you can get a decent job in a middle-class life for the most part, that provides sufficient motivation.
Well, let me pick up on that. And this was this piece that we saw in the New York Times yesterday about the graduation rule, the idea that colleges and universities should have some kind of responsibility to see their students through an education program, and also that would result in a job and a livable salary. What do you make of that rule, and are you concerned it will be either pulled back or gotten rid of?
Well, I think, frankly, that whenever taxpayers are paying a lot of money to support education, they have a right to wonder if what they're paying for is worthwhile. Over time, this country has prioritized choice, the ability for students to choose any sort of college they might want to go to, over taxpayers getting a good bang for their buck for that investment. And what that has meant is that businesses have gotten into this game, as they think of it, of college, meaning that we have what are called for-profit colleges that are educating students not, frankly, with really terrific outcomes of helping students get degrees and good jobs, but with the goal of generating a profit for their shareholders, which they're doing at great taxpayer expense. So this effort to hold them accountable for good outcomes is an effort to ensure that taxpayers don't throw their money away.
Is there a place for-profit colleges and universities?
You know, I think we need to have that conversation. We have been letting them exist for a long time, and not only letting them exist, but funding them to the tune of tens of billions of dollars of taxpayer funds every year. And we should ask ourselves, is that money well spent? For example, if we stopped funding for-profit colleges and universities in the United States using taxpayer dollars, we could reallocate those funds to pay for the 13th year of higher education in the public sector for virtually everyone.
You talk about having a conversation. Is it with lawmakers, stakeholders, the President of the United States? I mean, education, of course, is diverse, and it is in many ways locally controlled or statewide controlled. Who should have this conversation? And I have to say, having done this program for about 30 years, it seems like we're always trying to have this conversation about education, but we never quite get there.
It's true. And frankly, we've been having a lot more conversations for a long time about K-12 education than we've had about higher ed. The main conversation that needs to happen is actually with families, because it's the families who are bearing the brunt of the current situation. You know, when they think about the price of college, they do one of two things. One, they try to save for college, and they find it very difficult to save enough anymore. Second, frankly, they complain, and they complain louder and louder the closer they get to sending their child to college. Neither of these strategies is working anymore, because by the time that you're actually complaining and even thinking about voting to affect this issue, it's too late. It's actually the parents of young children, of kindergarteners right now, who have the ability to fundamentally change the price of college in time for their kids when they go, by starting to vote now for people who have real plans to make hard choices about where taxpayers put their dollars in higher education.
What is an example of a real plan then?
So there were plans that were discussed during the last election. It was really interesting to watch the Democrats versus the Republicans talk about ways to make college more affordable. On the Democratic side, you had a conversation about the relative roles that states and the federal government should play and institutions should play in trying to control costs and in trying to provide financial aid to those who need it. On the other hand, on the Republican side, we mainly saw accusations leveled at colleges and universities as if they were controlling their own prices when, in fact, states are doing most of the price setting. And we saw this general assumption that simply opening the marketplace up to more educational providers would somehow serve people better, when, in fact, over time, as more providers have entered the marketplace, so to speak, in higher education, college has become less affordable. So there were really big differences, and we did see some good debates and discussions on affordability, but as we all observed, over time, that got pushed to the side as other concerns once again took the day.
We heard at the top of the hour from Aminat Asee, who graduated from Community College of Philadelphia, now attending the University of Pennsylvania. She talked about just the hard work involved in being a student and, in her case, raising a family as well. We know about the dropout rate for college, for for-profit colleges and universities, but it's also true for community colleges and other colleges as well. How do we deal with that?
Right. Well, there are problems we can get our arms around, and there are problems that we can't. One of the problems we have with the for-profit sector is while they can take our taxpayer dollars, we don't seem to be able to control what they do with the money. They spend a lot of money on advertising and recruiting students and not a lot of money on instructing or supporting them. On the other hand, the public sector, places like the Community College of Philadelphia, those are taxpayer dollars we can do something about. If we want to ensure that students like the one you heard from earlier have the resources she needs to succeed in college, then we have a role to play at that public institution in helping to make that happen. One of the biggest reasons that more students don't graduate from the Community College of Philadelphia is not a lack of trying, either on the part of the student or, frankly, of their teachers or administrators. It's a lack of money. People would be stunned to find out how very little we give to these colleges to educate people who have faced serious challenges in their lives, but who are nonetheless trying to get ahead and become productive members of our city. I actually think that the future of Philadelphia, especially the economic and civic future of Philadelphia, lives or dies by how well we support the Community College of Philadelphia, because we can have a say in what it does and because it is a fundamentally democratic institution that we can play a role in.
I remember hearing about food pantries at colleges and universities because students were both hungry and didn't have enough money to actually buy a meal.
Right, and we need to grapple with this. I mean, when we say the college is too expensive, I think a lot of your listeners probably think we mean that they can't afford their books or their laptops or their iPhones. Well, I have been studying for the last 8 years the growing crisis of food and housing insecurity on our campuses. And our latest estimates, and we'll be putting out a new big study on this in a couple of weeks, suggest that as many as 1 in 2 community college students does not have access to nutritious food on a daily basis, does not regularly eat before they go to school, and 1 in 2 of them does not regularly have a safe and secure place to live. Should we be surprised that they drop out of college if we are doing nothing, the kinds of things that we do in K-12 education, to ensure that these students have eaten and slept before they enter our classrooms to learn?
1 in 2 meaning half.
Half.
Wow.
It's stunning.
It is stunning. That's Sarah Goldrick. Rob, again, professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University, author of a book called Paying the Price, subtitled College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. We'll be talking with Aaron Schenck in about 10 minutes or so, executive director of the Pennsylvania Association of Private School Administrators. Sarah, let me read a couple of comments. One from Barry. He says, nothing is free. A tweet from Marge. Yes, college should be free. A tweet from Dawn. Many community college students are struggling with two jobs plus little money, then drop out, underscoring what you just said. An email from Casey. Free college? Absolutely not. Society owes all of us opportunity to make our own paths, not the right to have one made for us. So there are interesting kind of themes back and forth. And education is a very passionate issue that people care deeply about and have very strong feelings about. With a Trump administration, do you feel like we are in an environment where we can have the kind of conversation that you're talking about, especially with Betsy DeVos, now the new head of the new Secretary of Education?
Well, listen, I mean, as you said before, education is fundamentally a local issue. And the good news for many of us is that the people you just named are not in charge of what we do on a day-to-day basis. Local people can make a real difference in this discussion. College leaders can make a real difference in this discussion. Pennsylvania can do what it wants in many important ways, regardless of what direction the federal government goes in. Of course, the price of college being free does not mean that the cost is free. Every day, we use libraries and fire departments, police stations, and elementary schools that we do not pay to access, precisely because we wouldn't have a real opportunity to access them for many of us if they did charge. We pay for it together because it costs less for each of us when we do pay together. To ensure real opportunity to education means not putting a price up front that can prevent people from ever getting it. And in this country, we have found that providing real access to elementary, middle, and high school has transformed this country into a technological leader, to an economic powerhouse, that frankly we will not be in this next century right now if we don't expand that to post-secondary education.
I've seen critics of remedial education courses at the college level or in colleges and universities saying that tells us that students are not prepared to do college level work and they should have chosen something else as something to do after high school. What do you say to that?
You know, what I say to that is that most of those research studies on remediation fail to take into account that those exact same students are often working two jobs. They're often working the graveyard shift. One in four students has a child. 13% of students are single parents. And this problem of food and housing insecurity disproportionately affects those same students. If we gave them the resources to succeed, if we didn't require them to pay so much for college, we would see higher rates of success in those courses. I'd also urge anyone to ask themselves whether if they went back to college today, having taken time off from school, whether they too might need a little additional help getting up to speed on something like math. A lot of these students have been out of school for a while in the workforce, and they're coming back to do better by their families. Second-guessing their preparation doesn't help anyone.
Do we also need a thriving economy so that when someone graduates with an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree or anything else, that they are they're confident that they can get a good job and a good paying job?
You know, despite all the talk about these people with college degrees who are unemployed,
yes,
what remains so important is that your chances of being employed, and in particular being steadily employed, right, not going through periods where your family watches you unable to work, those things are much more common for people with all sorts of college degrees, including certificates, including associate degrees, including bachelor's degrees. The people who are really struggling in this country are not as loud or not as vocal about it, but who are really struggling are the people who never got to go to college at all.
The first time, people who have, I guess, potential, but not able to access higher education.
That's right, and I think that we need to stop deriding those so-called non-college-educated voters, for example, pretending like they didn't want more education. Many of those people who end up with no college nonetheless wanted it and tried it, and they may very well have ended up unable to pay the price and dropped out with debt and no degree. There's a reason that they're upset. It isn't because they don't value education. It's because they've been locked out of the one opportunity to get ahead in this country, which is to build your skills.
We probably won't have time to squeeze in these calls, but let me just read one here. This is from Mark, who called our comment line. The question I have for your guests is, how expensive is debt today compared to years ago when you were adjusting for inflation? Is the cost of education, has that outstripped inflation in the last generation or so?
It has, and in fact, it's not even taken a generation. I think one reason that so many people are resistant to the idea that college is too expensive today is, frankly, that they haven't been paying for college in the last 10 years. We've seen really dramatic changes in the last 10 years, even to the cost of community college. Post-recession, as state support declined and also as families watched their own wages stagnate or decline, the price of higher education climbed dramatically. And so what that means is, whereas before, a student could go to community college and work while they were in school and effectively make ends meet, many, many, many are now having to take on loans and work and are finding it awfully hard to succeed in school while doing both. And that is contributing to what we're seeing now, which is this dropout problem with debt and no degree, which frankly may be worse than never having gone to college at all.
Because you don't, because if you never went, you wouldn't have that debt.
Exactly. And you wouldn't have this bitter taste in your mouth where what you did was try to do the right thing, only to learn that you've been penalized for doing the right thing while facing a price that you couldn't afford. And you didn't choose a fancy school. You didn't even choose the school you might have really wanted to go to. You went to your nearby school, which is what most Americans do. Mm-hmm. And yet it, too, was unaffordable.
How did you get interested in this? We have to say goodbye to you in about a minute or so, Sarah. But what is your interest in higher education, the cost, the opportunity, some of the problems associated with that?
You know, I think like so many of us, I care a lot about my history and my family. And my grandfather went to college on the first GI Bill. And like so many Americans, we watched the entire trajectory of our lives shifted because of that. He raised three kids who were able then, because he went to college, to go to college. He married my grandmother, who was college educated. She never would have dated him if he hadn't gone to college. And now he's got a granddaughter working at Temple University who are raising kids who undoubtedly will be able to pursue college educations and secure a decent life for themselves and their families. This is what people want for their families. This isn't too expensive. It's about making good decisions with our taxpayer resources, the sorts of decisions we made when we invested in those GIs.
Well, Sarah Goldrick, Rob, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Professor of Higher Education Policy and Sociology at Temple University, and again, author of a book called Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be joined by Aaron Schenck to talk more about the cost and value of education, of higher education, including career education. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Gina from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And although I think we should cover some of the costs of higher ed, I think one of our issues is over-specialization for a bachelor's degree, and that colleges would probably be able to afford to lower tuition costs if they didn't have to offer so many degrees at that level. So maybe we could just have advanced courses instead of advanced degrees.
Hi, this is Nancy from Landenburg. One of my thoughts is that we have a lot of students who do not get a complete education in high school, and it costs them a lot more to go to college because they have to take remedial courses for most of their first year, whereas really bright students or students who really study hard get sometimes as much as a whole semester of college completed before they finish high school through advanced placement courses. So it makes a great deal of difference how much education they get in high school.
Those are two people that called our comment line, and that phone number is 267-405-2006. You can also text us, 267-405-2006. Well, the stock market is bullish on for-profit colleges since the start of the Trump administration, banking on deregulation. And joining us now is Aaron Schenck. He's executive director of the Pennsylvania Association of Private School Administrators, representing private career colleges and trade schools. And Aaron Schenck, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you as well. What is a quality career school education? What does that entail?
Well, sure. Let me just start, if I could, make sure everyone understands when we talk about for-profit, you just mentioned the stock market. Yes, there are several large national companies that are for-profits, but when we talk about career education, the large vast majority of for-profit schools are actually your career and technical schools, your smaller schools, regional schools that are like truck driving schools, welding schools, culinary arts, nursing, cosmetology. So there's a lot of very small, either regional or individually owned schools that really are the primary, when we talk about for-profit schools, make up a large majority of what we are talking about. So I just want to make sure everyone... Go ahead.
No, that's fine. And I have a couple of just quick follow-up questions. And I looked at your list, and it does include automotive training and beauty schools and other technical and medical schools as well. What does it typically cost to get to graduate, to get, if not a degree, some kind of certificate?
Sure. Well, we've done studies of our members, and these are only Pennsylvania numbers. So I can't say nationwide, but and these are also averages. So obviously some are larger, some are you know, smaller. But for our schools, our sector in the state, the average for a tuition for a year is approximately $15,000. Compare that to other sectors of higher ed, the four-year independent liberal arts schools are roughly about twice that much. The publicly subsidized community colleges and state system usually come in a little less, usually around $8,000, $9,000, $10,000. So we figure, you know, we are actually competitively priced on average across sectors because our schools do not typically get a subsidy like the publicly subsidized ones do. So, you know, figuring that in, I'd say we're very efficient in terms of dollars.
So people are paying out of pocket $15,000 a year?
Well, some are out of pockets. They do qualify for some student loans and student financial aid, depending on their program, and also depending on their income measurements and other factors. Our schools typically do not receive government subsidies. So it's either tuition straight out of pocket or tuition that is at least partially covered through financial aid.
And what is the graduation and the employment rate for people that go to a career or trade or technical school that's part of your organization here in Pennsylvania?
Sure. Well, looking at primarily two-year programs or less, which is really if you look at majority of the for-profit or the career and technical post-secondary schools, looking at just those numbers, two-year programs or less, we have the graduation rate is actually extremely high. For on-time graduation, it's usually on average around low 60s, 61, 62%. But for on-time graduation in post-secondary education, that's actually a very high number. Look at the publicly subsidized two-year programs or less, they're usually around 20%. So we feel graduation levels are very high. Placements for job placements, again, averages, but on average, we're usually around 81, 82%.
People having a job in the field that they studied?
Correct. And that ranges a lot by the field, too, because we have such a diversity of programs. You look at some jobs, I mean, the high-demand ones right now, like truck driving and welding, and there are multiple offers to students before they even leave the school. Other programs, you get in some of the fine arts and some of the other programs that usually they're work-off commissions or other other kinds of employment, they tend to be a little less. So it depends on the field you're going into, but the average is around 80%.
What do you think of the Obama administration when they did apply this quote-unquote gainful employment rule? First of all, was it applied to the technical and career schools and colleges that are part of your organization?
Yes. It was applied. Basically, that rule, we have a lot of concerns with that rule, but it was mostly applied just to for-profit schools, and that's any kind of for-profit. That's the corporate models, that's family-owned, the regional. So it was largely applied to the for-profit sector. It did cover a few other programs, mostly non-degree programs at shorter public schools and non-profit schools, but the vast majority of the rule was applied only to for-profits and exempted out a majority of the other sectors of higher ed, which is one of the points I heard earlier. I think you had mentioned a New York Times article.
Yes.
That said that I think it was 98% of the gainful employment programs that failed were for-profit schools. Well, that's because simply the rule was primarily applied only to for-profit schools.
Should it be applied universally then across the board?
Well, we've made that argument for several years. I mean, we have concerns in the underlying regulation, but we have said consistently that if you're going to do this, if you're going to impose these kind of accountability measures, it should be applied across the board. And the irony is the other sectors of higher ed lobby hard to be exempted from that rule. So it is a rule that's primarily just applied to for-profits. We would think if it was applied across the board, you'd have a lot of other programs failing. And I just give one example. Harvard University only had one of their many, many programs fell under gainful employment. The only program that qualified to be covered under that regulation actually failed. And they have now shut that program down. And that's just one of many examples. But the bottom line is that a regulation that was specifically written to target a certain kind of school and exempted out a large majority of other schools.
And do you also agree that if these targets are not met, that a school should be shut down? Obviously, people are paying a lot of money, or taxpayers are paying a lot of money, in order for someone to get an education and hopefully get some kind of a degree or certificate.
We would agree that there's got to be accountability on outcomes, and the schools that we represent cover that through accreditation, through many other means. But in terms of the targets that the federal administration set up a couple of years ago, we have deep concerns in terms of how these are applied, and I'll give you just a few examples of some of the schools we represent. First thing is it assumes that every student that is going into one of these programs is going into it with the mindset they're leaving and going into full employment, and that's simply not true in some cases. We represent a lot of schools like cosmetology schools, massage schools that you might have a single mom or a parent that is not looking to go into full-time employment. They're looking for a job that they can have on the side in the evening or a weekend here or there, and if they go into part-time employment to their own choosing, the school actually gets hurt because of that. And there's nothing the school can do to control that. But it is, it's the school essentially gets dinged if a student leaves that school and decides for their own reasons to go into part-time employment. A couple of the other problems we see is it takes no account in the regulation in terms of tips. Again, talking about cosmetology, it's a heavily tip-based profession. We know that a lot of people in that field do not claim all their tips. The federal government has acknowledged that for years, but they only, under the reg, they only count their wage figures and do not count any of their tips that are not reported. There was recently a lawsuit that was actually just filed against the regulation on that specific issue on tips. The other thing we see, two other quick examples, is, for example, culinary arts programs. They have troubles passing this because a lot of their students are going into the culinary arts programs with the mindset that they're going to be either an executive chef or own their own restaurant someday. But quite candidly, their first year or two out of school, they're a line chef somewhere. And this regulation only looks at your first 3 years of income. It doesn't look at your long-term income growth. Another example we see is some of our hospitality and hotel management programs. Some of them have had problems passing the reg. Some of the students may accept the fact they're making a lower wage, but if they're going to be living on a cruise ship, getting free food, free roof over their head, and traveling the world, they will take that. They'll take that job with the understanding it might pay less in terms of wage. I could go on and on. So go ahead.
No, let me just jump in here. I noticed that DeVry University in Montgomery County is part of your group there. And when you go to the website, it says DeVry University previously advertised that since 1975, 90% of DeVry graduates system-wide in the active job market held positions in their fields of study within 6 months of graduation. Goes on to say the U.S. Department of Education asserted that the records maintained by DeVry were not sufficient to substantiate that representation. Thus, DeVry University could not substantiate this representation. Very legalese here, I should add. The university agreed to cease making since 1975 representation and post this notification on its website. But it seems to me that anyone who wants to attend DeVry or a cosmetology school or the University of Pennsylvania should have some information about the graduation rates and some kind of assurance of what they're being told is correct. And it looks like DeVry was really misrepresenting itself for some time.
Well, on the DeVry case specifically, I can't comment too much on that. I would say that from my understanding, I was not involved in that, but That was the several years of discussion between them and the FTC. It was based off marketing or advertising material from many years ago. I know they recently have come to a settlement on that, and that's about all I know and can comment on. I can talk to you in general about stuff that people that schools post on their websites and information that they can provide students, and we fully support students having as much information as possible. Outcomes measurements are what we specialize in, and we have no problem pushing outcome measurements and making sure students know those outcome measurements.
Would you represent Trump University? I mean, it no longer exists, but it did for some time.
Well, no, we never did. And quite candidly, that is, a lot of for-profits have been, have shaken their head at that, because quite candidly, that was not a for-profit college or university. That was a unaccredited real estate seminar. It had nothing to do with or look like any of our schools. The reason why it got in trouble in New York was because it used the name university, even though it was not a college or school. So that operation was not part of our sector, never was. Quite candidly, the school's representative looked at that and have had concern with the fact that it's been labeled a for-profit when it hasn't been or it wasn't.
What do you think of this idea of universal public higher education? That was our second guest, Sarah Goldrick-Robb. I know you were listening in, Aaron. This idea that we need to make higher education of, and perhaps we can include some of the career and vocational schools that you're involved in, is to make it, if not free, certainly very affordable to people so that they get the education that they need without being saddled with all that debt. Even $15,000 a year, if you're a cosmetologist, it's a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, and again, the $15,000, that's an average. The cosmetology schools are less than that. But on the discussion of the free college, look at some of, there's a lot of different proposals out there. Look at some of the ones the previous administration had. To be quite candid with you, we're talking billions of dollars to fund, and that's just from the federal level. We saw a lot of studies on what that would cost, and quite candidly, I don't know which, no one knows which numbers are accurate, but the bottom line is was several billion over a multiple year period. But on top of the federal commitment to that is that part of the proposal that was put out was it required a state commitment as well. If you look at the debate in Harrisburg right now, there is simply no state money that's out there to commit to something this significant. And then the third piece that is, when you're talking about community colleges, the other tier is it requires a community match. It's supposed to be about one third. It doesn't always happen that way, but it would require either a county commissioner's office or a local school district to basically provide a match at the local level as well. If we're talking about community college, so candidly, the dollars are it's a huge financial commitment, but beyond the dollars. I would also say that if you're looking at community colleges right now, they make up about 5% of the schools in the state. Putting that level of investment into 5% of these schools is a considerable investment.
You know what, Aaron, we have to end our conversation only because we're out of time. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Hey, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Aaron Schenck, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Association of Private School Administrators. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.